with another edition of the Stampede Wrestling Show.
Hey, happy to have everybody here tonight at Heartbeat Radio. Happy Mother's Day, May 11th, 2014. Heartbeat Radio here on ProWrestlingPowerhouseRadio.com. I'm your guest host tonight, the Cowboy, Johnny Mantell, and with me is, of course, one of the great Hart brothers, Bruce Hart. Bruce, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, and I'd like to echo your sentiments. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there and to all the mean mothers in the wrestling business, too. So happy Mother's Day to all of them, and thanks very much for guest hosting tonight, Johnny. It's an honor and a pleasure to hook up with a legend such as yourself. So I'm delighted to be able to be on with you, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of fun and share a lot of perspectives tonight.
Absolutely, man. And we're going to talk a lot about the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame with the inductions next weekend, and I want to tell everybody that it's a great class. But I also want to tell everybody next Sunday, the 18th, you're going to be with the Renaissance man, Les Thatcher, and wrestling journalist Mike Moneyham. And then the following week on 5/25, it's the 15th anniversary of the Owen Hart Show, and you're going to tribute show, and you're going to have some great people on, man. Brian Brer, Mick Foley, Jimmy Cordeas, and Jeff Jarrett, man. It'll be a great night that night.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to all of those. It's always great talking to people that have the same passion and have been around. And, you know, I'm always thrilled and delighted just to hear these stories, because I've been around the business for most of my life. But quite often you don't get a chance to talk to guys who have stories about the road or the different odds and ends from, like, your neck of the woods, Texas, or Thatcher's in Ohio and Mooneyham's in Carolina. And even when I was working all the time, we were always intrigued to hear the stories about Carolina or Tennessee or Florida or any and all of that. So it's always kind of an adventure for me on the radio, even listening to that. You know, it's kind of like, wow, tell me about Ric Flair or Terry Funk or Fritz or Gino Hernandez or whoever, you know. So those should all be fun. And
having Les on like that, you know, he can tell you, he'll tell you stories on guys that, you know, we were talking about last night, that a lot of guys today don't even recognize or know their names, and Les will have stories on all those guys.
Oh, yeah, and so many of them had left a huge footprint, or they had a huge influence on today's working and all kinds of stuff, you know. And a lot of the modern fans, unfortunately, don't even know you know, the influence of so many of those guys and some of the styles and the angles and the gimmicks and the personas and all like that that they pioneered. And a lot of people, like we were talking last night, unfortunately, a lot of today's fans think maybe wrestling business evolved from Hulkamania or WrestleMania or something like that, you know. And there were so many diverse and, you know, fascinating, really larger-than-life characters in our day or even before us, you know. And I'm always intrigued to hear from a guy like, say, Les Thatcher or Mike Mooneyham, you know, maybe the true stories on some of those old farts from the 50s or even before, like the Ruffy Silverstein to the Ricky Starrs or the you know, the Becker brothers and guys like that. Maybe most people haven't even heard of them today, but a lot of those old Mexican guys like El Medico and Bronco Lubitsch
and Gorman and Goliath. A lot of guys don't even know who that pair is, and my goodness.
Oh, yeah, them or El Medico or old Luis and Gino Hernandez and Bulldog Danny Pletches. Some of those old guys that, you know, were the guys who really laid the groundwork, Denny McShane and guys like that, you know, and a lot of the saddest part for me, maybe, Johnny, is that a lot of the boys don't even know any of those names. Like, we probably do because we've been around and we kind of are sort of deeply rooted in the history. But I know when I did WrestleMania a few years ago and I was shooting the shit with some of the boys backstage, and you throw out some names of these guys that you figure everyone must know, you know, so like some of those names I mentioned, you know, and they didn't have a clue who almost any of them were. You know, they didn't know even names like Nick Bockwinkel, and you throw out some of these old guys that maybe were kicking around in my era, like Don Jardine and Stan Stasiak, and you know, they'd be go, who, you know, and I'd say the spoiler or whatever, and never heard of them, you know, and it's like, whoa, you know, at least I know baseball players, you know, to, like, if you mentioned Joe DiMaggio or Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays or Juan Marichal or whatever, you know, most of them at least know who those guys are, but it's disconcerting to see these guys in our business who are making money and perceived as stars, and they're unaware of so much of the history. A lot of them didn't even know who the hell Johnny Valentine was, and I said, like, Greg Valentine's dad, you know, and they're all, you know, oh, I think I've heard of Greg, you know, and I said Johnny Valentine was like a damn giant, you know. He wasn't just sort of some guy's father. He was considered one of the great workers of his era, and a lot of them had never even heard of Buddy Rogers, you know. They're all like, who's he, you know, or, you know, it was, so I'm hoping just during the course of this show, you know, we can at least kind of allude to some of those guys and maybe bring some people's attention to them, because they were all, you know, huge influence on today's work, and they were some of the best workers I've ever seen, and I'm sure you got a bunch of them from your neck of the woods that I'd love to hear about some of the Texas guys,
well,
you know.
You know, and what you're saying is so true in today's business, and that's why, as you and I have spoke, you know, I try to do as much as I can with the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame that's in Amsterdam, New York. They are trying to preserve the history and trying to recognize the guys in this business that meant so much and that were the guiding lights of what's going on today, and we are a few generations removed from that era that you're talking about, with all the characters and bigger than life people and all those kind of things, and the only way to preserve it is to talk about it, discuss it, preserve some of the material and some of the artifacts, and put it in a Hall of Fame and a museum, and that's what's happened in Amsterdam, New York. And this year, being the 13th year of inductions, they have a great class, and they start off in the Pioneer era with Leroy McGurk and, of course, your father. And what a pair to go in the Pioneer era, and really pioneers in this business.
Oh, yeah, those are two. I think a lot of the fans today have almost lost sight of the old school mentality, but Stu and Leroy were two of the guys who were really deep-rooted amateur. They had, you know, they were both like national amateur champions and had, you know, a real kind of amateur pedigree. And they, you know, if you broke in either Calgary or Oklahoma, it was sort of obligatory to, you know, go through the, you know, the dungeon. Or Leroy, I heard, used to, you know, stretch them, and he and both Stu and Leroy, they had almost sort of a little bit of a partiality for these amateur wrestlers like Luther Lindsay and George Gordienko and Danny Hodge, and so it was always sort of you know, emphasis on legitimacy and paying homage to their roots, but you know, there's not enough of that today. You know, I think there's a few guys like Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, but unfortunately, a lot of the guys I don't think, a wrist lock from a wristwatch, So I'm glad to see, that should be still something that they should be endeavoring. I don't like to criticize the demigods, but beyond everything else, it still should be wrestling, or it should resemble wrestling, So I think they should never lose sight of that, and I think all too often it almost gets lost in the shuffle with the talking and the soap opera and the gimmicks and the all the other, quite often I'm seeing it and I'm going, where's the wrestling, nothing wrong with working a hold and, mostly doing wrestling and maybe having a high spot or two mixed in. But nowadays, all too often, that's unfortunately almost kind of lost in the shuffle, which is something they need to address. But we can discuss that another time when we're, dissecting it more. But Stu and Leroy certainly two of the legendary old school promoters and shooter types, so certainly very worthy inclusions in the Hall of Fame. And you've got another brother there.
And that pioneer era is 1898 through 1942, again, that's a large span, and there's so many wrestlers from that era that people need to know about that were a major part of this industry.
Yeah, and I'm interested to hear some of the other names. I think you and I were discussing it the other day, but there was like a wealth of really incredible pioneers, very few of them, much to my dismay, are in the WWE Hall of Fame, even though they're, the giants of the, they're ranked right up there with, say, if you were talking about baseball players from the pre-40 years, everyone knows Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and Honus Wagner and Shoeless Joe and all like that, but sad to say, too many of these old wrestlers, and there was like a myriad of these legends, like the Frank Gotches and Hackenschmidts and Strangler Lewis and Joe Stecker and Earl Caddick.
Jim Lundis.
Jimmy Lundis and Everett Marshall and,
Lou Thesz.
Lou and Bill Longson and Bobby Manigoff and Dick Sheikat and, a whole bunch of them that are I'm hoping some of these people listening out there, are remembering, or those names ring a bell to some of them, because those are guys, like, those are the equivalents of the John Cenas and the Hulk Hogans and the Dwayne Johnsons of that era, they certainly, I'm pleased that they're being remembered, or they're noted in the your Hall of Fame, because, if, like you were saying, if those guys weren't, unfortunately they'd almost be forgotten. Nobody would, in today's era, would even have known who the heck they were, so.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm going to jump to the next division. The next division is the television era, and those dates are from 1943 to 1984. And this year's inductees are really two different styles in the ring, but two styles that were very productive, and that's Bruiser Brody and Mr. Wrestling Number 2, Johnny Walker. And those two, again, had very maybe different styles in the ring, but they both got the job done.
Oh, yeah, they're both huge in, for a long period of time, too. Like, some guys will maybe have had a run in a territory for 6 months or a year or something like that. But both Brody and Johnny Walker, Rubber Man Johnny Walker, Mr. Wrestling, those guys were sustained their level of excellence for like a decade. You know, they were strong, and wherever they went, they did good business. You know, they were kind of box office, and both very highly respected guys within the industry. You know, they're guys that you never hear anyone have a bad word to say about either one of them. You know, and Brody, unfortunately, is most of his fans obviously know he was unfortunately killed in a backstage accident or whatever in Puerto Rico there, but yeah, he's very well regarded. And Johnny Walker, I'm happy to say he's still alive, I'm told, so you know, both very worthy recipients. And you were telling me, Johnny's
going to be at the induction ceremony, and Bruiser's wife's going to come and accept in his honor, and I apologize if this hurts anybody's toes right now, but I stumbled over that right there, but I'm just going to say our dear friend Bruiser was killed in Puerto Rico by somebody backstage that night. Now that's just the facts of what happened.
Yeah, and yeah, I'll leave it at that. You know, it's anyone who's familiar with Bruiser or whatever is aware of the apparent circumstances, and it's kind of just one of the real sad, unfortunate tragedies of the wrestling business of that era, you know. So, but Brody's reputation is still, strong as ever, you know, amongst the wrestlers and the fans who knew him. You know, he's still considered, kind of an icon and one of the kings of hardcore or whatever. You know, he's sort of one of the guys who, almost kind of was the forerunner of that whole style. You know, and he, not too many guys ever did it as well as him either. You know, it was guys like him and Terry Funk and a few of them that were really, you know, made that an art form, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, I got, Bruce, I'm going to bring on one of our callers tonight. I see that we have Dan Murphy from the Pro Wrestling Illustrated on tonight. Dan's always been so nice and polite to me. And Dan, welcome to the show tonight on Heartbeat Radio.
I'm glad to be here, guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Dan. It's delight to have you on, and say hi to my old buddy Bill Apter.
Will do. Yeah, and Bruce, I've had the opportunity with Cauliflower Alley to meet a few of your brothers, meet Smith and meet Ross, and I've interviewed Brett in the past, so it's a pleasure to hear from you and to be on the show tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I'd love to hear some of your enlightened perspectives on any and all of this stuff. You know, I'm always delighted to talk shop with guys who have been around. I always love to hear different perspectives and stuff, so I'm sure we'll enjoy it tonight.
Very cool.
Hey, Dan, we're just sort of going down the list of the inductees into this year's class of the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, and the next era is the modern era, 1985 through the present. And the two inductees this year are Don Morocco and the mass superstar Bill Eadie.
And that's terrific. Those are guys who I think are really, you look at how wrestling took off in the 80s and the superstars that everybody knows and are the Hulk Hogans and the Roddy Pipers and the Iron Sheiks and, the superstars who have really kind of lived on in the popular mainstream attention. But you look at those guys, Mass Superstar and Don Morocco were tremendous talents who I think maybe were kind of underrated. They may not have gotten the recognition that they really deserved at the time. Fantastic careers for the two of them, and it's really great that the Hall of Fame is giving them their just due.
Yeah, really, you know, both of them are all old buddies of mine in Morocco. I spent a lot of time with him in Hawaii, and we had Bill Eady up here as the Max Superstar many a time. But both of them are a credit to the business, you know. And both worked WWE a little bit. I think a lot of the fans don't even remember. Like Bill Eady had a couple of incarnations before he ever did the demolition.
Before demolition,
WWE.
Yeah.
He's like the Masked Superstar, and he was like one of the really there's like a handful of those masked guys that really you know, are at a higher level than so many of the others, and he was one of them. He even had a previous run, from what he told me. I didn't know until he was up here. He told me he was originally one of the Mongols with Newton Tatry and Nikolai Volkov, who later.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and old Tatry was, I don't know if it was Beepo or Gito Mongol or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was out of Pittsburgh, Edie, and he told me he did the Mongol thing, and then I'm not sure if he was so chagrined with that he had to wear a mask or whether he went somewhere else and evolved into the Masked Superstar, and he had a hell of a run in, I think it was Atlanta and that area, you know, back in the Jim Barnett days when that was a really one of the really super territories. You know, it was like one of the big money territories back in the 70s. So he was kind of pretty well established. I think when I met him was in the early 80s and first in Japan. And then we brought him up here and, you know, he was a hell of a worker beyond everything else, and really class guy too, old Bill Eady, you know. He's you know, professional and never gave anyone any grief, and very well respected by the other boys, you know. And I've never heard anyone say a bad word about him, you know. So, but you guys have probably crossed paths with both those guys too, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I had started up with Pro Wrestling Illustrated. I kind of came in after that era. I started up in 97, but I was watching from, you know, maybe 82 on, and I've been kind of a student of the game and going back to, and that's one of the great things about the Internet now. I heard before I came on how you were saying how it was a shame that so many of the current guys don't know about the standard bearers of the industry beforehand, and that's, it's really a shame, especially in this day and age where you can find those matches. I mean, you can go to YouTube, you can go to other sites and DVDs, and that information is more available now than it's ever been. You know, a generation ago, you may have to do tape trading and try to find somebody through the back pages of a magazine like Pro Wrestling Illustrated or whatever, a pen pal type thing, or people in another country or town and be able to send tapes back and forth, be able to see what was going on. Now with this and with the WWE Network now, hopefully that'll broaden it even more. But it's a great thing that opportunities with technology can kind of work with the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame and educate the current crop of fans. You know, the 8, 9, 10-year-olds who are into John Cena now, maybe 5, 10 years from now, they can learn about Jim Londos, and they can see Argentina Roca and all of these fantastic stars from the past and how wrestling got to where it is today.
I'd love to see Vinny and them do that. I think it would enhance people's perception of them if they can enrich and refortify the apparent foundations, even if they embellish or use poetic license or whatever. But
yeah, everything gets filtered through their unique vision a little bit. So,
yeah, like if it was up to me, I'd be alluding to Frank Gotch and George Hackenschmidt and Joe Stecker and Stanislaus Sabisco and Wayne Munn and Dick Sheikat and Jim Browning and Jimmy Londos and Everett Marshall and all of that stuff, you know, and, you know, kind of touching on the legendary stars and the title changes, and Lou Thesz first won the belt in 36, and you know, he was still going strong in the 1980s, and you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, and the Argentina Rockers and the Orville Browns and the you know, the Whipper Watsons and the, you know, Gene Stanley and Buddy Rogers and, you know, Pat O'Connors and Dick Hutton and all those guys. You know, there's so many of them. You know, I kind of grew up on them, and I was sort of in awe of those names as a kid growing up. You know, they were kind of like a little kid who admires Babe Ruth or Ty Cobb or Walter Johnson or whatever. But I was telling Johnny before, though, I was disconcerted when I was at WrestleMania a few years back and just, you know, shooting the shit with some of the guys, and I was like taken aback at how few of these guys, you know, a lot of them didn't even know who like Buddy Rogers was, or they had no idea who like Pat O'Connor or Dick Hutton or, you know, I'd mentioned Luthez and I've heard of him. What territories did he work in? Stuff like that. You know? And you're like,
yeah, was he in ECW?
Is he one of, in NXT or something like that? Or is he, you know, where does he work now? I'd say, well, he's, you know, he was working in the 30s to the 80s. You know, he was one of the pioneers that laid the groundwork for all of you guys. And, you know, I was taken aback at how none of them seemed to know of any, damn near any of those guys. And I was like, whoa, those guys, you know, those were like the pillars, you know, those weren't just sort of guys who were, you know, obscure workers that, you know, picking names out of, those are like the giants that, you know, gave the business integrity and all the other, you know, for decades, not just, they had a run in a territory for a few months or something like that. They were, you know, huge, you know, iconic people in our industry, you know, which is, goes back to what I was saying about Johnny in the Hall of Fame. You know, I'm glad that it's hopefully sustaining and preserving the reputations and the images of those guys, because those guys were giants in their time, and back then the wrestling business it was taken a lot more seriously, and the perceptible integrity was a lot, you know, stronger.
It had to be protected too. You know, it wasn't the like it is today, where you can get shoot videos and you can find everything else. You needed to be able to go. You needed to have, you know, real wrestling skills, submission skills, and be able to protect yourself, because you never knew somebody in a bar who's going to try to take liberties, or an opponent in a different territory. And all that's kind of gone away.
There wasn't too many, weak-kneed wimps masquerading as champions back then. You know, most of those old farts had cauliflower ears and, they had been in the dungeons or the sweatshops and all of that, you know, and a lot of them even came up, like my dad, they came up in the carnivals and stuff where they had to, take on all comers and all like that kind of stuff. So it's a different era, but I think it's, you know, important that a lot of those things are preserved and made known in the Hall of Fame, you know, because those guys, they weren't flying first class, or they weren't getting staying in five-star hotels. You know, they were pounding the highways and staying in, the cheapest place they could find, and driving 1,000 miles to and from a town and all this other. You know, there was a lot of dues paying back then, you know. Sort of like the old days of the NFL or something, the Canton Bulldogs and the, Providence Hornets or whatever the hell, you know, the different era, you know, and those guys weren't, most of them had to work day jobs. So they, you know, nobody was getting rich back then, and but it was for the love of the game, you know, to use the cliche, and I'm hoping a lot of the young guys maybe take heart and, have some appreciation for how those guys laid the groundwork. And I'm hopeful some of our friends in Connecticut ever also kind of, make themselves aware of some of that. Sometimes I think it gets forgotten, but I think they need to respect and preserve those things, you know, in order to make people respect them today, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, again, and Bruce, you and I have talked about it, and I hope, Dan, you know, I hope you know a lot about the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame up there in Amsterdam, New York. They are trying to preserve it, and I know they have a room full of VHS and 8mm and 16mm and all of these different tapes that they're documenting and labeling, and eventually that'll be on a run throughout the Hall of Fame. And to go up and see footage of Billy Robinson or Everett Marshall or some of those kind of guys back in the day working is just spectacular to see that footage. And you're absolutely right, Bruce, when you say the guys of today, they could watch these guys work an arm for 5 or 6 minutes. And us sitting in the audience watching that footage, we believe they're working the arm for 5 minutes. And that's how good those guys were.
Maybe 25 minutes, Johnny Valentine, you know, he'd work an arm and keep coming back and keep coming back. And, you know, some of the critics of that era, you know, for the first 5 minutes, they'd be half whining about, you know, when's he going to do something else? And 10, 15 minutes later, the crowd's going nuts and he's still working the arm. And the other guy does one little thing and, you know, there's like a near riot going on. And that was what working was all about, you know. And there were so many of those guys of that era, you know, like the Johnny Valentines and the Buddy Rogers and the Wilbur Sniders and the Luther Lindsays and guys like that who almost could conduct the orchestra at will, you know, as we used to call it, you know. And they just, you know, keep coming back to the same thing. And systematically and methodically they would build to this incredible climax. And I think even old Dory Funk Jr. was a huge proponent of that kind of thing, you know, and Harley and those guys. And then somewhere in the era since Hulkamania, it seems to have almost been, unfortunately, deprogrammed or that type of thing's almost been kind of lost in the shuffle. But I think... they need to revisit some of that because that was so intuitive, and the ring psychology was incredible. And those guys, they had incredible confidence in their ability to work the crowd. You know, you would know, Johnny, because you've been around some of them, and they were just very patiently and painstakingly. Another one was that old Dick Murdoch, who you knew pretty well, but he was the same kind of thing. He was mostly a heel, but he would just keep calling, you know, grab an arm and keep coming back to it and tackle, arm drag, get it again, you know, all that other. And sometimes, you know, I remember when I was just breaking in, I was kind of a bit restless or impetuous, and I like get impatient with these old guys like the Stomper and all, and they just have you keep coming back to the same thing. And 15 minutes later, the crowd's in a frenzy, and you go and you've hardly even done anything, you know. And you know, but I think some of today's masterminds need to revisit some of that, you know. And that was what working was about. And I think you and I discussed it more than a few times, but there was very little scripting back in the day, at least when I was breaking it. It was all improv. They used to use this term, we'll play it by ear, which was the veteran's way of telling the rookies, I don't want to see a list of choreographed high spots, you know.
That was just basically telling you to shut up and listen, right? I mean, that's what they were telling you.
Yeah, and if you're maybe the promoter's kid, or you had, you know, they respected you a little, they'd say, "Well, play it by ear." If you were just a rookie or whatever, they'd, you know, in no uncertain terms, shut the hell up and we'll do it my way, and don't tell me, give me a 20-page, you know, list of spots you want to do or any of that bullshit.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. Last night I was out at the Ring of Honor show in Toronto. It was their iPay-per-view, the War of the Worlds event. It was the guys at Ring of Honor, and they brought in New Japan. And it was a tremendous show because, you know, Jushin Liger was there and AJ Styles and Tanahashi from New Japan, Okada, and a lot of the young guys. A really exciting show. But it was all spot fest. Dude, every match was this sprint of get spots in, get spots in, get spots in. And the crowd liked it. It was the right audience for it. But the main event, there was the champion, Adam Cole, took a powerbomb to the ring apron from the floor, lifted up and powerbombed onto the ring apron. He got picked up and crotched in all four corners, you know, picked up for like a belly-to-back suplex, and Kevin Steen ran him in and crotched him in all four corners. And then he got a brainbuster from the superplex position, brainbuster onto the top turnbuckle, and he wasn't selling any of it. You know, he's taking these incredible moves. You know, two count, kicks out, jumps up to his feet. He's throwing super kicks like it never happened. And, I mean, it was great for the crowd. They loved the spots. But you just think of these guys taking this kind of beating and taking those risks.
I feel sorry for the poor bastards. And they almost become slaves to that. You know, I used to know this poor bastard, Terry Brunk or Sabu, you know. And
Yeah.
He's like that. He's... He can't actually just go out and have a normal match, you know. All the fans, you got these twisted marks going, holy shit, and you fucked up and all this bullshit,
right,
you know.
Right.
But, yeah, he can't go through a match without going through the tables and all the goofy, high-risk, you know, painful, knock the shit out of your body. And Jeff Hardy's the same, you know. And, and you know, it's like their greatest hits, and the fans want it. But you know, my honest belief is you got to almost precondition and recondition the marks again. You know, so I remember Johnny. You probably remember back in the day, like a pile driver was like a stretcher job finish. It wasn't, you know, most guys were carried out if you did a pile.
And, you know, we've talked about it, and Dan, you know, you're talking about the matches from last night, and what happens is you waste so many finishes and so many moves that pretty soon, what are you going to do? You know, what else is going to be left?
My dad used to always say sarcastically, what are you going to do? You're going to have to bring them somebody's head on a platter or some bullshit like that, you know. And, but after a while, It's very Pavlovian, you know. You push the button and you get the chicken pushes the button and it gets the seed. But if you start deviating from it, you push the button and you don't get one, or next time you get 14, and you know. And the fans are like the chicken, you know. I don't like to, I'm not denigrating them, but you have to sort of, you lay the groundwork and you have to stick to your own stuff if you keep deviating. I saw a few years back when I think it was Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker were at WrestleMania or something like that.
Yeah.
Undertaker does a tombstone and Shawn kicks out. And I think some people were thinking, wow, they've reinvented the wheel. But for me, it was like Bluto making a comeback after Popeye get the can of spinach. You know, you're fucking up their perceptions, you know. This is a finish for all intents and purposes, and then when you deviate and it's not a finish, what it really does is just disillusion the fans, and if they get too disillusioned, then they just tune it out. That's my experience. So, you know, you go to all this trouble to make a certain thing a finish, then you need to stay, you know, stick to that, you know. And as soon as you start changing it up, I find the fans, even if the holy shit marks who are wanting to see somebody killed or die in the ring or whatever, you know, even they, after a while, you know, after the 14th time you kick out of a tombstone or whatever, I think they're more like, what now, you know, that's one of my problems I've had with Ring of Honor and some of the Japanese stuff. I broke in a lot of the Japs over here. They used to send almost all their top guys back here, including Liger and Hase and Hashimoto and Sasaki and Hirata and all these guys. And we always had to deprogram the Japanese guy. We had some spectacular guys in Stampede at the time, too, but they had a bit of a method to the madness. And I remember all those guys, Georgie Takano and Liger and all of them, you know, and even guys like Dynamite were telling them to slow down, do half as many spots, you know, and when you do them, make them mean something. And a lot of them became a lot better over here. Liger was a good example, you know, and I think they need to remember that. That was always one of our problems with them. And Johnny would probably relate to that, but back in the 70s and the 80s with the Mexicans, you know, it was just sort of high spot, or combinaciones, as they call it, or whatever the hell, you know. And I remember the old farts like Stomper and Bad News Allen, and some of those guys would, you know, unload on them, and they wouldn't sell there, you know, and they'd, you know, the Mexicans were big on always coming up to you before the match and giving you, like, you know, 20-minute lowdown of you do this and I do that and I give you two of these and you give me two of those, and then, you know, and your head would be spinning after about 20 minutes of this, you know, scripting. And most of the old farts would just say, screw that, we'll play it by ear. And they didn't even want to have to remember or be a slave to all the combinaciones and all the high spots and all that bullshit, you know. And I think it needs to go back to that, you know. Once you script everything, one of the main problems is you take the fans out of it. Like, because you're going to do all this stuff regardless of whether there's any fan reaction or not. And that's a critical part of it. And that was always a big part of improv, was that, you know, you're playing it by ear, which was you're listening to the crowd, and if they're buying it, you go that direction. If they're sneering at it, you know, scrap that and go in another direction on the fly, you know. And that enabled you to maintain contact and be interacting with the crowd, which is one of the big important pillars of the whole thing, you know. And too many guys these days, you know, haven't been appraised of that, you know, and that you can see it in their work.
Well, do you think the scripting, Bruce, is done because the talent hasn't been up and down the roads like we were to really learn how to get in the ring and script and do it right? You figure that's why everything's scripted?
I think that's part of it, and I think part of it is arrogance on the part of the scripters or the powers that be, where they essentially are treating workers or wrestlers as little more than human mannequins on a puppets on a string, and they almost want to control the which to me is an insult. I'm sure you'd agree, Johnny, back in the day, if a booker, like if I was a booker, and I came up to Harley or Dory Funk or Gene Kaniski or something, and gave them a move for move, you know, run down, you know, 30 minutes, and you do this, and he does that, you know, they would politely tell me to go fuck myself, you know. And, you know, I'm sure you'd agree, you know, if you went up to one of those old Johnny Valentines or Ray Stevens or Buddy Rogers or whatever, and, hey, buddy, you grab this, and he'll do that, and then two of these, and duck, clothesline, leapfrog, and cartwheel, and, you know, and then get it again, and then you do a nip-up, and, you know, after a while, you know, if they were even still listening to you, you know, their eyes had stopped rolling, they'd, you know, tell you we'll play it by ear if they were being civil with you. In most cases, they'd, you know, tell you to, you know, screw that, and don't tell me how to work, son. I forgot more about this than you'll ever learn, and all that kind of thing, you know. But yeah, to me it isn't an insult to any decent worker to come up. Like if I came up to Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk back in the heyday, and you know, say they're working our territory, and I came up and assumed that they wanted to hear my finish, you know, they'd be like, you know, we weren't born yesterday, we don't need some wet behind the ears punk like you telling us how to orchestrate a match, just, you know, stand back and let us do our thing, you know. And I think it's like that, a veteran in any sport, you know, if you had some you know, white coach coming up to Peyton Manning and giving him, you know, this newfound lecture on football. Probably say, you know, I've been doing this shit for 20 years. I have a bit of an idea of what the hell I'm doing. And
yeah,
you try to go from there.
You're not going to fix the wheel, right? I mean, you're just not fixing the wheel. You can make modifications or change the byproducts, but the wheel's still round and still has to grab tread, and that's, I think...
Oh, yeah,
you know,
totally. It's all just about working the crowd, and I may be that old school. I'm not a huge fan of even, you know, I see no point whatsoever in, you know, dirt sheets and these wrestlers seeming to obligatorily telling people before it happens what's going to happen at WrestleMania, or he's going to be dropping the belt, or he's switching to face, or, you know, for me, all that stuff's, you know, I can't wrap my head around all that. You know, we used to, in Calgary, very rarely you would even give the guys their finishes till that night. You know, a lot of them didn't know what we were doing until we got them in the dressing room that night. You know, we didn't want them smartening up their girlfriends or all that, you know. And quite often you just give them finishes because you would gauge, you know, what the crowd's mindset is on any particular night. So you would kind of have it evolve from there, but I'm not a huge fan of scripting like 6 months down the road, because there's so many things that can change, you know. And I'm not a big, like, say I was like, I'm sure WWE's probably already got something in mind for SummerSlam or something like that. And for me, you know, you got enough, you know, things that can change, and this guy might be getting over more than that guy, or all kinds of things that kind of arise. So I've never been a big fan of sort of a general game plan, but, you know, it should be subject to change.
Well, that's what's interesting with what happened this year with Batista. You know, Batista's big comeback and wins the Royal Rumble.
He was supposed to be a face, and the fans were kind of
lukewarm
to him.
Yeah, and the thing is, luckily WWE, and one of these rare things, they weren't married to, you know, he was the main event guy, and they kind of changed things on the fly a little bit and went with what the fans were giving them, which is pretty rare. You know, it's kind of cool to see that happen. But it's definitely, like you were saying, Bruce, you know, you can't be married to an idea if the fans just aren't having it, and you're planning 6 months down the road, and, you know, if you're going to try to force feed them, it's just going to, they're going to reject it.
I think they more than anyone need to be, you know, their arrogance or whatever else needs to be put aside, and they got to recognize that something's not getting over, and they got to change. I was told, like, when they first brought Steve Austin in, they were going to call him the Ringmaster or
yeah,
some such thing, and then I heard the reaction was so lukewarm or whatever that they fortunately decided to change on the fly, or they kind of modified it. But I think you got to constantly be doing that. And I don't like to criticize the geniuses, but if I was them, I'd be playing my cards, you know, would have been for the last 30 years, playing my cards a lot closer to the vest as far as not orchestrating finishes or not letting anyone know what your plan is, and on any given night, even insiders are like, you know, caught off guard. You know, I find that's the best way, where nobody saw it coming. You have like a heel switch, or you have a baby face doing something, or you got some kind of, you know, radical change of something. And I know in our territory, you know, quite often the only guys who even knew what was going on is maybe, you know, one or two guys, or even quite often my dad or myself wouldn't even let them know till the night of the show. And he'd come in and tell some guy like Dynamite, we're switching you to heel, or we're doing this or that. And it used to have incredible shock value, you know, the stuff that always got over the most is the stuff that nobody saw coming. And all too often, I think WWE misses the boat on that. You know, if I was down there, I'd be doing something like totally out of the blue that nobody saw coming, and there was no kind of lead-in or no symptoms or, you know, and then bang, you know, even the boys are going, whoa, I never thought they were going to, you know, do this or do that or switch that, you know. And I think there's still a lot of room for that, you know, and at no point should they ever become too much of a slave to the big business or, you know, where they, I always hear all these rationalizations why they have to, you know, let everyone know what the finish is beforehand and all this other, as far as I'm concerned, it's all BS. You know, the booker wanted to come in the night of the show and say, okay, tonight we're having, Dean Ambrose double cross Roman Reigns or something, bang, you know, it might grab him and nobody, you know, but if everyone already knows, and with all the internet and all that stuff these days, you know, for me it's, it kind of screws up the whole thing when it seems like everyone knows well in advance, you know, and I don't know what the point of that is other than, satisfying the smart marks of the WWE universe or whatever the hell they want to call it, you know. I still have trouble even uttering that term smart mark because as Pillman used to always say, it was a contradiction, like an oxymoron.
Yeah, it's like jumbo shrimp like or something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, let me step in and just say you're listening to Heartbeat Radio tonight. We got Dan Murphy with PWI, Bruce Hart, and I'm standing in tonight as the host, Johnny Mantell, and we're just sort of talking wrestling, and we're talking about the Hall of Fame inductions coming up this next weekend and throwing a lot of names and history out, and I hope that everybody out there that's listening is taking note to some of these guys. And like Dan and Bruce and I both all said, you know, you can, with the modern age, and I'm sure not the most modern guy in the world, but with the modern age out there, the internet and computers, you can look these historic people up and figure out who they are and what they are and what they've done and realize their journey and how it's really affecting your journey today, whether you're an independent star or whether you're somebody getting in with Vinny up there in Connecticut or Ring of Honor, wherever it may be. These guys had a push or something that caused you or your direction to happen or made your direction. These stars don't line up just because. They do because we aren't very far separated at all. And I want to bring up two old names, and I'm not saying that to be rude, but the tag team going in this year are the Fargos, Jackie and Don Fargo, and Don is still alive and will be at the induction ceremony. And what great stories those guys can tell.
Hopefully it's not X-rated with him.
You'll have to put the mic on a seven-second delay there.
Well,
yeah,
I gotta tell you,
like one of the legendary degenerates and characters of the, I think everyone, I'm sure you too, Johnny, must have a few Don Colts or Don Fargo stories. You know, I remember.
I gotta tell you, I saw Don this summer in Tennessee.
And he probably
reunion.
Looks still pretty good, the old fart. He always stays in shape, you know.
So
what's
soft
he gotta be, about 80 or something? He's gotta be near his late 70s, I figure, you know.
So soft spoken, so polite, so nice talking. What an artist.
Oh, yeah.
Drawing characters now of a lot of the guys, and what an artist he is, and he is so humbled and honored by having their tag team recognized, and well deserved. They drew a lot of money.
Oh yeah,
all
he was beyond all his predilections for degeneracy or whatever. He was he was a great worker. You know, I remember he. One of the guys he broke in up here, he sort of had taking him under his wing at that time was Greg Valentine. They were up here, and Greg Valentine was at that time wrestling under the name of Johnny Fargo, and they called themselves the Fabulous Fargos or whatever. And but yeah, he was. I was just breaking in, getting my feet wet, and I remember Don Fargo. He was always up to some some corner, you know, kinky debauchery on the road and all that stuff.
And that was the era of the real ribbers, right? I mean, they would rib everybody and anybody.
Anything. And, you know, it was always, they'll probably save the listeners out there and digress into, you know, all the debauchery and all like that. But yeah, he was like one of those guys who was one of the legends. There was a few of them that sort of, you know, were... Even old Ray Stevens a bit, and Buddy Rogers, and some of those guys. But they all came from that era, you know, and they almost felt like they had to liven up the road trips or whatever. So they're always up to something, whether it was, you know, they drive by your car, pass you on the highway, and everyone's ass would be hanging out the window, all that kind of stuff, you know, or kind of evolved from there. But yeah, he was one of those really characters that gave a lot of, you know, color and vibrance to the business, old Don Fargo. And he was a good guy in the dressing room, too. You know, he's never, you know, he's always up to the pranks and the debauchery and stuff. But yeah, he in the ring, though, was always... 100% business, and he was like, I'm sure Valentine would tell you that, Greg, Don Fargo was, he was a great mentor for so many of those guys, you know. Old Jackie, but I heard good things about him, too. He was sort of mostly in Tennessee in that area, you know. So.
Yeah. You know, Don told me a great story that really told me two stories that really tells the story of Don Fargo and the Fargos as a tag team. He was telling me here recently that he's been sort of working with some kids there in Florida and trying to help them get started, and they asked him to make a road trip with them to a wrestling show and come watch them wrestle. So he thought, well, cool, I'm going to get to make a road trip again. So he was looking forward to it, and he said, I got to tell you, it was the most boring trip I ever made. They both were pushing on their phones and doing stuff, and there was just no interaction, no anything. And then I got one other little quick story telling you the real side of Don Fargo. When he was first starting and they were trying to find their way or find their gimmick, a promoter suggested to him, and right now my mind's going blank on what promoter at that time it was, he said, did, but they wanted him to do a Ku Klux Klan gimmick. So Don and his partner went to a Ku Klux Klan meeting so they could get the robes and the hats so they could try that gimmick. It didn't work out. They didn't like it. But that's what they did to try to play the part at that time, to be that part, to get the chance to work and try to get over. So that's what a lot of those guys in that era, you know, they would sort of throw a lot of mud at a wall and see what would stick and what would work. You know, it was like, you know, Bruce, you and I were talking about Mr. Wrestling 2 and Johnny Walker. He had bought a gas station and had got out of the business when he got this phone call to become Mr. Wrestling 2, and bada bing, what a run he had.
Oh, I remember meeting him when I was a kid because I think he was having to chaperone the midgets or something like that, you know. And I remember back in the day, you might remember, like, back in the day, they'd always have, you know, the midgets would come up, the four of them, and they'd have some old, you know, worker kind of coming up with them and driving them and all that other. And then, as I recall, Johnny Walker was, and he was doing that rubber man Johnny Walker gimmick at that time or something. And I think he had to come up with either the midgets or the girls or something like that, you know. And I remember, like, there was sort of like that old Frank Valois who used to have to be, like, the valet for Andre the Giant when he was doing his stuff back in the 70s, you know. But yeah, so many of them paid their dues, you know. It was you know, it's almost interesting. You see some of these guys who evolved into big stars, and like old Harley told me, when he was breaking in, he had to drive Happy Humphrey around, who was like an 800-pound blimp or whatever the hell we had on. It's sort of fascinating. I think a lot of that stuff has almost been forgotten, you know, but very few guys were ever like superstars overnight. I mean, almost every guy you talk to, whether it's Harley or, you know, any of those guys from that era, Buddy Rogers, whatever, in most cases, you know, they had a different incarnation, or they were having to do jobs, or they were, you know, playing this role or that role somewhere else before they finally, you know, got their so-called break or whatever. And I think that made them that much more appreciative of the break and the push and all like that.
And I know, Bruce, you and I have talked about it, and Dan, I'd like to get your opinion on it. When he just said that Harley drove this guy around, and I'm sure I drove Ernie the Cat Ladd around the first summer I was in the business, and I'm sure Bruce has driven some guys around when he was early on in the business.
Oh, yeah, I refereed about 2 years, you know, just
set up
the rings, all that other.
But I think those adventures and those trips with those guys was the way that the young guys were taught back then, and it was a big way of teaching them the business in the real way. And I think in today's world, I think, and again, Bruce and I have talked about this, I think now Vince and the organization there is now rethinking their idea of shutting everybody down and only being the only thing running, because the guys don't get the opportunity to travel and be with the guys and learn the business.
Oh, yeah, that
the
was
way
invaluable.
You did as an 18-year-old kid.
I was just going to say that the thought now is it seems to me that what WWE does in a lot of ways is they almost don't want they want the guys to come in with a clean slate. They want to anything that they learn on the road, or a lot of things that they learn on the road, they try to condition right out of them.
Part of their problem. I think they need to go the other direction. Like Johnny and I were talking about it the other day, but in Calgary in the 80s, we had an incredible mix. We had three or four guys from the South, like David Schultz and Honky Tonk and Danny Davis and Ron Starr, and then I had the English guys like Dynamite and Davey, and we had some Japanese, and we had some of those guys from the Maritimes like Leo Burke and The Beast, and you know, we had a few guys that come up from Amarillo, you know, Cyclone Negro and some of those guys, and Head Stu's own guys, and maybe a few guys from Portland like Rip Oliver, you know, some of them, and then a few wild cards like the Bushwhackers, or you know, and everyone would bring stuff to the table, and
right,
you know,
and it was different. It was different styles from different territories,
and everyone was sharing the talk on the road, and we try stuff that had gotten over in England, and one of the Japs would say we did this in Osaka, and then you know, the Bushwhackers who were from New Zealand would say we did this thing down in Steve Rickard's territory, and Duke Myers, who would come up from Hawaii, would say Peter might be it, you know, and it was always a hybrid. You know, you'd have a little bit of and the flavor was incredible. You know, he had all these guys from different backgrounds, and it really enhanced it, you know, and you didn't have any one set style and all like that. All too often in WWE, the style's so damn stagnant and stale that, you know.
And that's what they want. Yeah, they want to make it interchangeable. And what they'll do with a lot of times, and it's almost a liability with some of the guys who have worked overseas or have learned other styles, because they have to then go to the new performance center that they built down in Orlando.
Well, it's really stupid. I remember like Dynamite and Davey when they went down there. First went down there in the mid '80s from here, and they were seasoned. They were world class, two of the best workers in the world at that time. And I remember them telling me, and they were not pleased about it that they were told they had to put on some weight, you know, however, and which I didn't think was good for them. But beyond that, they told me they were, you know, all of a sudden Pat or whoever was, you know, screw those spots and we don't do this and and quite honestly, Dynamite Kid that WWE fans might remember was, you know, a shadow of what he, you know, he was like 10 times better than. And my brother Owen was the same when he went down there.
You know,
they had him in all these horseshit roles like the American Eagle and High Energy and other, you know, and he was a way better worker than he was allowed to, manifest. And I think they need to put aside their own arrogance, and you got to work the guy's strengths, but you also got to recognize that diversity, you know, is a welcome alternative to the fans.
And this is a real quick thought on that, and to kind of bring it back to the Hall of Fame too, because this is a thought I kind of had last night as I was leaving the Ring of Honor show. I drove from Toronto back to Buffalo, so a couple hours, and I'm kind of thinking it all through. It's really interesting that for so long the WWE tried to distance itself from pro wrestling and try to rebrand itself as sports entertainment, and then with their Hall of Fame, they're now kind of becoming this repository for a lot of the territorial stuff to a degree. But at the same time, they kind of try to distance themselves away from it, and they try to take the edges off of guys who come in from the independents or other territories. Daniel Bryan, when he can really go, is Bryan Danielson and everything.
Oh, yeah.
He's one of the best in the world. And now, like you were saying, with Owen and others, Dynamite, he's only being able to do maybe 15% of what he can do. So it's really kind of interesting to see how the Performance Center is going to take off and shape things. But at the same time, Daniel Bryan is still the biggest star in the world right now, and he's drawing with what they've made him, turned him into. It would be interesting to see how he would do if he was able to kind of go all out. And the other thought being with the kind of back to the Hall of Fame point, it's great that there is the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in New York, where despite the kind of fads at the time and what's in and what's out, you have something like this that's an independent entity which can really kind of enshrine people that are deserving of it, you know, years later, when their style may be out of vogue.
I would like to hope the WWE, even if they're doing it under the table or, you know, not, you know, being recognized for it, I'd like to see them throwing their support monetarily or however, you know, behind that Hall of Fame, because it, in its own way, it legitimizes them. And I think it's better that they remain independent of it, you know. If they were all of a sudden calling it the WWE Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in Amsterdam, New York, the whole thing would lose the cachet that it needs. But nonetheless, I think, you know, if they were to allot some money and allot some support for it, I think it would be good for them. And
absolutely.
The other thing I was talking
absolutely,
about, you're talking
man.
About these, like, the WWE's developmental and all like that. I think it's all well and good to develop talent and all like that, but where that talent really learns how to work is not in the sterile confines of his training camp or whatever. It's, as Johnny, I'm sure, would attest, is going on the road for a year or two and traveling the roads and doing 5-6 shows a night and working with different guys and having the opportunity, if you're lucky enough, to ride with a Dick Murdoch or a Harley Race or a Terry Funk or a Pat O'Connor or a Ray Stevens and pick their brains and talk shop with them and ask them questions. And there's no substitute for that, you know. And at the time, I didn't consider it any great luxury, and quite often they weren't all that diplomatic. You know, I'm sure Johnny would tell you the same, but you'd be riding back after a match, and you'd have the old farts grilling you and saying, why the fuck are you doing this? And, you know, don't do so much of that. You know,
They would smarten you up one way or the other, either coming or going,
yeah,
or after the fact or before the fact. That was just part of the education of this business. And I got to sneak in and say, you're listening to Heartbeat Radio again, and you've got Dan Murphy of PWI, Bruce Hart, and your host tonight, Johnny Mantell, on the air. And I'm bringing on another member of the Hart family, Ross Hart. Ross, can you hear us?
I sure can, Dan. It's a pleasure to be on. Hi, Bruce. Hi, Johnny.
Talking to you.
Yeah, I'm just taking a break from one of my niece's weddings. Bruce had to miss the wedding because he was doing a show tonight. But anyway, it was my niece Brooke and Pistol Pete Wilson, who's a pretty good independent wrestler here in Calgary, and was trained somewhat by Bruce and my other nephew Ted. But anyway, I took a break from the wedding to be on the show here, and I'm excited that I'll be attending the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in Amsterdam, New York next weekend, and I'm very honored that my dad is being inducted in the Pioneer Hall of Fame category with Leroy McGurk, and I think they both contributed so much to the development of territories and breaking a lot of guys into the industry in the 60s and 70s, and they really paved the way for a lot of guys to break into wrestling and become big names. I think Leroy did a tremendous job in Oklahoma and Louisiana and the Mid-South, and my dad certainly had a huge impact with Stampede Wrestling in all of Western Canada. But anyway, it's a pleasure to be on with you, Dan, and Johnny and Bruce as well.
Hey, Ross, my better half and I will be in town on Tuesday. And, buddy, if you need anything while you're up that weekend, I'd be more than happy to show you around, man. This is our fourth year going, and we're really excited to be there and be a part of your dad going in.
No, that's fantastic, Johnny. And I left my brothers, Brett and Keith, at the wedding, and they passed on their best wishes to you. I know they toured New Japan with you, I think, in June and July of 1980, and they just had tremendous respect for your ring work. They just said you were great on the tour, and I think you had toured New Japan before them a few times, and you helped them a lot because it was their first tour for the Inoki office, and they couldn't say enough good things about you. And Ken Mantell as well. Ken was the NWA Junior Heavyweight Champion. You both were outstanding workers and were tremendous assets in all the territories that you worked in. And I wish we'd had you up in Calgary here.
I wish I could have made that trip. And I'll tell you, I had made about six or seven trips before I made that trip with Brett and Keith. And we had a grand time, I'm telling you. I showed them where the pizza place was and Rivera Steakhouse and all the spots, man. So we had a fantastic time.
Oh, yeah, I
remember
them coming back from that, and they couldn't say enough nice things about the Mantells. So they still hold both of you guys in highest regard.
Well, I appreciate that, man. My brother had such a tremendous career in this business, and I felt like myself, I had a great career working. I did spend a lot of time at home with my daughter and home with my parents, and I did run horses for many years, so I wasn't near as busy as a lot of people and didn't get to see quite as many territories, but it sure allowed me to travel the world and see the world on the wrestling dollar.
Absolutely. You certainly have a great kind of idea and perspective of the business, so sounds like you had an opportunity to share perspectives with so many of those guys, because it's tough to develop that passion without kind of interacting and all like that. And
we talked about it just a minute ago, and I do believe that those trips, I mean, I was 18 and training in Los Angeles and training with some of the greats in the business, yet Peter Maivia flies in and stays Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Leo Garibaldi gives him as my responsibility from Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I'm picking him up at the airport, bringing him to the Olympic, taking him to the hotel, picking him up, taking him to Bakersfield, bringing him back to the Olympic on Friday, and then back to the airport to fly back to the islands. And all those trips, I might have been a gopher at that point in time, but I was a gopher with these ears wide open and eyes wide open, hearing the stories and the way to do it and the proper way to handle it and those kind of things. So when you learn and travel with those kind of quality people, and you know, I don't like throwing out a lot of names, but again, Peter Maivia and Pedro Morales and Victor Rivera and Pampero Firpo you go to Dory Funk and you travel with Ernie the Cat Ladd or Killer Carl Cox, and you travel Grizzly Smith and Skandor Akbar. You travel
Killer Buddy Austin,
you just have to learn. I mean, whether it's the Assassins and Jody Hamilton and Tom Ernesto and having the privilege of working as a worker for bookers like Leo Garibaldi and Tom Ernesto and Red Bastien and Scott and you know.
Oh yeah, those are all iconic names. You know, I certainly every name you've mentioned, you know, it's kind of my mind brightens just hearing those names. You know, it's been a long since I've heard a name like Tom Ernesto or Red Bastien and all, but those are, like we were saying before, those are some of the iconic legends and builders and people that enrich the business that probably not too many guys today even know who the hell Tom Ernesto is or, you know, some of those other names you mentioned, you know, and they were all, you know, huge impact on the generation, like Peter Maivia or some of those other old Victor Rivera's. And I count myself fortunate. I met almost every one of those guys or worked territories with them. And every one of them, you know, had something they'd bring to the table. And, you know, I consider myself fortunate. I had a chance to shoot the shit with, say, Victor Rivera or Peter or Rocky Johnson or Killer Buddy or some of, you know, and almost every one of them, you know, they were so generous with their advice, and they'd, you know, take time to give a rookie or whatever a bit of advice, you know, and it was all very sincere too, you know. I'm hoping some of the vets today are still like that, where they impart stuff, but unfortunately there's not enough of those old veterans around to share their perspectives, you know. That's one of the causes for concern with the maybe the future of the business. But like the Hall of Fame, like you were saying, I think it in its own way serves to help reinforce and propagate, you know, some of those things.
Yeah, and you know, for the boys in the business, you know, I tell them all the time, it took me 8 years for Gene and Davey O'Hannon and Ray and everybody to talk me into going up to the Hall of Fame. Now Kay and I are making our fourth trip up, and I tell everybody, if you're in this business, you're involved in this business, if you're a fan of this business, you're cheating yourself if you don't go to the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame and spend a couple days, because you can't see it all in one day. The posters, the magazines, the outfits, the boots, the hats, the capes, the things they have there, they're just, you know, they're just history. And for Ross or Bruce or I to walk through there, it's like you're walking through and seeing your life, because you see your name on a poster, or you see all these guys on a poster, and you've either worked with them or been in dressing rooms or cars with them. And it just sort of brings you back to reality of how close all of us really are that are part of the fraternity of professional wrestling.
Yeah.
You know, Johnny, I was just going to say, I went out to the first year with the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. I think it was maybe 2002 or so. When they first opened up in Schenectady before they relocated out to Amsterdam. And it was really just such an incredible vibe, because it was so new, so idea, so novel, the concept of a physical pro wrestling Hall of Fame, a building with those exhibits. And I remember seeing Killer Kowalski and Oxbaker, two guys who kind of stood out that I remember specifically. And these guys were over the moon. They were so happy to be there and meeting fans and being honored at that kind of a place. And it's so cool to see the support from the wrestling community, where you have the wrestlers being honored and being able to kind of, like you said, see parts of your own lives there and still be able to interact with the fans, where the fans can go and educate themselves a little bit more and possibly, you know, speak to some of the wrestlers, learn some of the stories. And it's a very rare place where you can get that kind of interaction. It's pretty incredible.
Which guys do you have coming down this year, Johnny?
Is there any notable old legendary
wrestlers or workers going to be taking it in? I think, that would be a huge part if I could even meet some old legend or at some of those functions. I know at CAC used to be able to chat with some of the old, guys in the back, Gene LaBelle or Lou Thesz or whatever, and it was always like, just a privilege or a delight to talk to someone.
I know this year that the inductees, Johnny Walker and Bill Eadie and Don Fargo are going to be there. I also hear that Greg Valentine, Brian Blair, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, Davey O'Hannon, Ray Ray Apollo, who was one of the Doink the Clowns for Vinny.
Yeah,
Stan Hansen. I hear Stan Hansen's going to be there. Bruiser Brody's wife is going to be there to accept in his honor.
Oh yeah, that's a great list of, if I was a fan, I'd be like, it would be a thrill to, if I could chat for a while with any of those guys. It'd be like, wow, this is and almost all those guys, the guys that I've run into them in the past, they're, unlike some other sports, they're more than accessible. You can sit down and have a beer with a guy like Paul Orndorff or Brian Blair, and they'll engage you for half an hour and sign an autograph or take a picture or tell you some story or something, and wrestlers are great for that. So that's nice to hear, because that's a really nice list of guys. All those guys are really personable, engaging type guys. Old Stan Hansen and Johnny Walker and all like that. I'm sure they all got a story, and that would make the trip worth its while just in itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I've been to the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. I think it was about 3 years ago I went in Amsterdam, and it was great. The banquet itself was fantastic. I'm not sure who's emceeing. Are you emceeing it, Johnny, or I'm not sure.
I believe Brian Blair is. I think Brian Blair.
Blair. Oh, yep. That's great. Well, Brian's very well spoken. But, they give each wrestler who's being inducted an open mic, and they can go up and speak as long as they like. And the stories they tell, what some of the matches they had, the memories on the road, even some of the pranks that were pulled, or the lighthearted moments that got a lot of the boys through the
Don Fargo
long
might
road
be there all night.
Yeah. Don Fargo might, so, and I think there'll be some wild stories with Don Fargo and Greg Valentine. I think a few people who know the history of Greg when he broke in for us in 1970, I think, is Johnny Valentine Jr. I think his dad
sent him up to work for us, Johnny Fargo.
And then he left after, and then formed a team with Don Fargo, and I heard his Johnny Sr. was pissed off as hell because Don was quite a rabble rouser and Johnny Sr. didn't want Greg under his influence, but they had a hell of an impact as a tag team. Yeah.
That's like the pot calling the kettle black on Johnny Sr. He wasn't exactly a saint either.
He wasn't.
F.J. York or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, the Alaskan J. York. Oh, my goodness. What a name from the past. The Alaskan J. York.
Yeah,
my goodness, man. Could we tell stories about him?
Yeah, the lighter fluid in the atomizer or whatever. The business used to be rich with those names and those characters and those, bizarre scenarios, and just that in itself would make, going down to Amsterdam, just hearing firsthand, and you got a real rich mix down there with Fargo and Valentine and Tony Walker and some of those other names you mentioned.
Yeah,
all those guys, I'm sure, have some really incredible stories that, just fascinate you, and hopefully they'll share some of them up on the podium there.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Guys, we got about 35 minutes. I know I got a couple callers wanting to get in. Bruce, I'm going to take a phone call, and I think it's Bobby Valente. Bobby, are you there? Hey, Bobby.
I really like what I'm hearing about the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, keeping the great history of the wrestling business alive, opposed to, like the WWE, which really only tells their own story with their own stars. And I'd like to hear what Bruce's take is on it, where even some deserving stars aren't even in their Hall of Fame, such as Owen and the Bulldogs.
Yeah, I still believe the Hall of Fame that in Amsterdam is to me like the equivalent of the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Covers all the bases, and like if say the New York Yankees or something had done their own Hall of Fame, which is sort of like the I don't even know if there is an actual WWE Hall of Fame is like you can actually go to, and I surmise it's all just online, or it's just sort of hypothetical, so to speak.
Yeah, no physical building yet. Maybe at some point, but not yet.
Well,
I think
what you're saying is right. That like the Texas Rangers have their Hall of Fame, and I think the Minnesota Twins have their own Hall of Fame, and some of these pro teams do have their Ring of Honor or their own Hall of Fame, whatever they may call it. But the thing about the Amsterdam Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame and Museum is it has artifacts in there from the Civil War era of professional wrestling, and that's the history of this business. We have to keep it.
Yeah, and that's I think what really legitimizes it, or like if you go to Cooperstown, and you can really kind of immerse yourself in all the every little aspect of it, so I think, as I said before, I think WWE should be lending themselves, they should be recognizing, or they should be thanking you, anyone that's been one of the builders and the people putting that together. All they're doing is honoring them,
Well, I think we had Tony Villano, the president of the Hall of Fame, on last night, Bruce, and Tony was a New York State Athletic Commissioner. So I think instantly he may have heat with Vinny, because, of course, that's why Vinny changed it to Sports Entertainment, was to quit paying those fees to the Athletic Commission. So there may be a little thing, but as time goes on and as more of our generation, and I'm talking about Ross and Bruce and I's generation, gets in higher positions and more positions within the WWE, I hope that maybe some of us on the committees and with the Hall of Fame can sort of close that gap. And, like I mentioned last night, just last week the WWE was in Albany, New York. In my younger day, I could throw a baseball from Albany to the Amsterdam at the Hall of Fame, yet none of the boys were up there a day early or spent any time at the Hall of Fame. They just went to Albany and worked. That is such an unfortunate situation.
We were saying earlier in the show that so many of those legendary names you're talking about that are in the Amsterdam Hall of Fame, 90% of the workers in WWE don't have a clue who the hell Jimmy Londos is, or Strangler Lewis, or Dick Sheikat, or, some of those other iconic names, which is really a travesty, but I think it would be if I was in WWE at men, I'd be having them all go out there and learn about the roots of the wrestling business, and I think would enhance their respect for the business and ultimately for themselves too.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope that as time goes here, we can. I understand that the WWE is trying to secure a building in Florida for their own Hall of Fame, and I respect that for their own Hall of Fame and for their memorabilia and for what they're doing for a profit. But again, the real Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame is a non-profit. It's run by a board of directors. It's not for anybody's favor or for anybody's own society. It's done by a legitimate vote that is counted, and if there has to be so many votes made each year to make it a real ballot, and it's done by your peers. It's a floating panel that votes. It's not always the same group. It's not always the same people. That voting panel changes, and the committee that runs that voting panel changes. So it's not because somebody's letting a friend in. It's not done that way. It's because the peers and the people that respect this business say you deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, and I think that's what makes it so important. And we're going to have to, as years go by, we're going to have to come up with ways, and Dan and your group are going to have to be a part of this. You're going to have to come and help be a part of a situation where here in a few years we just can't elect WWE stars. We're going to have to elect some of these independent guys out there that never got a break anyplace and never got to see the big show for whatever the reason was, that deserve it because they have the passion and the talent that puts them into that position to deserve that honor.
Yeah. There's still a huge variety of wrestlers out there who aren't being seen by the majority of fans, obviously. And every year PWI does the PWI 500, which I do a lot of work with every year, and I'm going to be starting soon. But we try to rank the top 500 guys. It's our way to really try to.
Is there even 500 left in the business?
Oh, my gosh. Believe it or not, there's more than 500 is less than half of the people we look at. I mean, because you've got the international guys, you've got people from Mexico and your luchadors in Japan and throughout Europe and then throughout the independent promotions. And some of the guys are weekend warriors or whatever, but some of them are really talented guys.
If there's 500 workers out there, how does Great Kelly still retain a job?
that's the problem. It's not always talent.
Bruce, that's the thing that I find the most intriguing about the future and the inductions and the Hall of Fame and stuff, is because we're going to have to recognize some of these independent guys with passion that have never been seen and haven't got a chance. They've worked a day job Monday through Friday and wrestled on weekends for 25 and 30 years, and they have that same passion that we had. They just never got that break, and there has to be a way of recognizing them at some point in time, and that's really going to be a challenge in the future. And I'm sure that the way the voting committees are set up and the voting proxy is set up, that'll be included, because it is part of this history that we do want to retain and keep.
I think it's great that they're honoring the legends who paved the way for a lot of today's stars, but they're also recognizing the future stars from different promotions. If it's not the WWE, then All Japan or New Japan or the various promotions in Europe, the different promotions in Mexico and all the independents in Canada and the U.S.
Dan started to say it, and I'll sort of finish that sentence, Dan. The world of professional wrestling today, in my era, there was the Funks in Amarillo, Fritz in Dallas, Blanchard in San Antonio, and Bosch in Houston. So there was four promoters that covered the state of Texas. And actually, Leroy McGurk and Mid-South covered Wichita Falls just up the road from me. They ran a show in Wichita Falls. So really there was five promoters that ran a town or two, at least, here in the state of Texas. Now, in today, 2014, there's over 100 promoters in the state of Texas. And wow. a lot of them use their own talent. They don't switch out talent much. A lot of them just use their friends or people they've trained or whatever. And I'm not saying that it's all what Ross and Bruce and I would say is wrestling. I'm not going to say that.
But filtered
in amongst those 100 promotions, there's some kids out there that have the same passion, the same drive, the same desire to be as good and be as true to this business as all of us were.
That's a really tough thing. Like you were saying before, as the conversation was kind of going, how it was such a great learning opportunity to be on the road with the guys and be in the car with the Killer, Carl Cox, and all of the different guys that you had named in that. Today, the guys coming up don't have that. They're working for different promoters, and the promoters aren't necessarily, you know, you don't have the Funks, you don't have these people who are established in the territory. A lot of times the promoters are, they are, honest to God, they're marks. They're marks
they're
without money, and they bought a ring. Yeah, and the thing is they're driving from these little shows, and they're picking up bad habits, or they're hearing from other guys who are filling their head with stuff that's not, you know, they don't know what they're talking about.
Too many of them are trying to do everything but wrestle. They got the costumes,
exactly.
And they're doing the high spots, and they got the skanky manageress with the fake tits,
yep.
And all the bullshit. And there's
nothing bad about fake tits. Come on, let's.
And, it's everything but wrestling, and
right.
And the guys, there's no kayfabe, and you know, and all the most of the people in the audience are friends and family and smart marks, and the whole thing is, you know, for me a perversion of what it should be. I think, you know, I might sound old school, but I still think you know need to endeavor to maintain kayfabe, and you need to use the wrestling to set up the high spots, and you need to, everything should have a purpose, you know.
Yeah,
if you tell somebody
guys
to become a Martian or something, you know, like everything should be within the realm of believability or credibility. And I would, you know, in the old days, Johnny would tell you the prelim matches, you know, they used to get, you know, if they did anything above and beyond just going out and warming up the crowd, they'd get their asses chewed out if they were doing high spots or hitting guys with chairs or going out on the floor. You know, it was all very sort of systematic. And,
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I had Leroy McGurk or Grizzly Smith or Bill Watts or Jody Hamilton or one of those guys say, okay, you need to go out and you need to wrestle 10 minutes. I want you to stay on the mat. And lots of times, that especially that first summer I was breaking in, the Assassins were in Mid-South, and lots of times, in those days, they'd have a captain's match that would start the night off, and then that captain's match was part of the tag team that was the semi-main. So that first summer in the business, Leroy and Bill Watts did to me, I did that every night, six, seven nights a week, twice on Saturday, twice on Sunday. I would work the captain's match and then come back and work in the tag match. So I would put in
35,
45, 50 minutes a night. And I'm 18 years old working with Jody Hamilton and Tom Ernesto, and literally they would tell you when to shake a leg, when to pick your arm up, when to do, and they were giving you that PhD education in professional wrestling. And I never complained because, first off, Bill and Leroy paid very well in those days. You were working at least seven, if not nine or ten matches a week, and you were working with the legends. I mean, the first summer in the business there in Louisiana, I worked with Stan Hansen, Dick Murdoch, the Assassins, the Medics, the Oates Brothers.
Wow.
I mean, the names just went on, and they all, yeah, they'd rough me up every so often if I did something wrong or stupid, but they were teaching me what to do.
The ever-present pecking order in those days, too, the rookies, myself included back then, even though I was like the promoter's kid. You know, very rarely were you even invited to offer your input. You know, you just sort of listened and did whatever the veterans told you to do. And if they solicited an opinion from you once in a while, you sort of felt honored that, what do you think of this, you know, but for the most part, you just, you know, you could learn, you, as my dad used to say, you can learn a lot if you have your ears and eyes open and your mouth shut, you know, and that was the way it was.
You know, Bruce and Ross, you'll love this, and Dan, you'll love this story. I was 18 years old, and Leo Garibaldi got me my first trip to Japan for New Japan Pro Wrestling, and I get there as an 18-year-old kid. I fly over on the plane by myself, no other wrestlers on it. They pick me up at the airport, and they get me to the hotel, and I don't speak a word of Japanese, and, you know, they're telling me what and when and this and that. And so the next day I meet everybody when I get downstairs to get on the bus, and I'm on a trip with Tiger Jet Singh and Bad News Alan Coedge and these kind of guys, and the first night we get to the show, and it's the big building in Tokyo, the Sumo Palace, and it's sold plumb out, and I'm in the main event, me and Tiger Jet Singh against Antonio Inoki and Tatsumi Fujinami.
Fujinami,
at 18
right?
years old.
At 18
wow.
years old, and so
wow.
they. Tiger tells me you have to start the match, so me and I go out and do a little thing with Fuji. And first off, I had been prepped by Bruiser Brody. Bruiser Brody said, you go over there and you kick their butt and wear them out till you blow them up, and they'll tell you, let's go home. So I went over there sort of with a chip on my shoulder, and I'd call a spot, boy, and I'd lay it in and really hustle it up and make it look good. And so I did a couple little spots with Fuji, and he tagged Inoki in, and boy, the crowd went ooh and aah, and I tied up with him and called the little spot, and man, he was Johnny on the spot on this spot I did, and I jumped back up to my feet, and I went over to the corner, and I leaned into Tiger Jet Singh, and I said, wow, man, he's the guy that fought Muhammad Ali, and he just did that with me. But it was part of a learning process that you just don't get today, and it's very unfortunate for these guys because it would make them so much better. I'm not saying that there's not some talented kids with the WWE. There's some very talented kids up there, but can you imagine how much talented they would be if they had those kind of opportunities? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I think a big part of the talent right now is they're I see some athletics and some incredible ability to do spots and stuff, but what's missing is the method to the madness, you know, and we used to get that from those trips and just the regularity of, you know, 5-6 days on the road, you know, with the same group of guys for months at a time, and, you know, it was hard not to learn and get better and all like that, and they don't have that same working environment, and they all have this more is better attitude right now, you know, more high spots and more chair shots and more this and more that. And in actuality, it's the inverse or the reverse of that, you know, less is better. And what's important is doing it at the right time and building to a climax and setting the table and all like that, you know. And so many of them, if you say that, they don't even know what the hell you're talking about. You know, what are you talking about more? Is it better? You know, of course it's better to do 20 moonsaults instead of just one or whatever, you know. And that's one of the problems of the business, you know. And too many of the guys in the indies are all trying to be a cheap copy of the WWE. If I was giving them advice, I'd tell them, dare to be different, try to be an alternative. I remember back in the day when we were launching Owen and Pillman and Benoit and Liger and all those guys,
mm-hmm.
I was almost disdainful of the WWE, which is Hulkamania and Warrior and all that stuff at the time. And I would tell them, screw all that stuff they're doing in New York. I want you guys to go out and be a compelling alternative. And they bought into that, and they all, as you know, became like iconic stars, the Owens and the Benoits and the Pillmans and the Ligers and all like that, you know. And I'd give the same advice to today's guys and say, don't try to be the second coming of John Cena or Randy Orton or whatever. You know, try to be a fresh alternative to that. you know, and dare to be different. It takes a hell of a lot more, you know, guts to try something new. There's a zillion Elvis impersonators out there that are starving in lounge acts, and, you know, so I think a lot of the guys never hear that, though. They're all kind of going out blindly and hoping, they're not sure why anything is going to work or how or whatever, and they really need to rethink things, and I think ultimately they'll be of far more value if they ever did get to the WWE, if they come in as something new and fresh, which is all Bryan Danielson and Phil Brooks and some of those guys were. You know, they were something new and different, not kind of, you know, recycled, trying to copy Hulkamania or trying to be the second coming of Dwayne Johnson or Steve Austin or whatever the hell, you know. And I think they still need to be striving to be a compelling alternative than kind of a cheap imitation of something that's already kind of worn out and overdone already, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
On that note, guys, I'm going to break away here, but Johnny and Dan, it's been a pleasure being on the air with you, Bruce as well, and Johnny, I look forward to seeing you at the Hall of Fame banquet next week, and Dan, I'm not sure if you're going to be there, but if not, I hope to meet you in person sometime, and I look forward to being on the show again.
Sounds like a plan. Enjoy the rest of the wedding.
Hey, Ross, thanks so much, guys. When
do you get in?
I'll see you later, the gang.
Sometime Friday. I'm flying in from New York and then catching a ride up Friday morning sometime. So looking forward to seeing you there, Johnny.
We'll see you Friday afternoon. And,
okay.
And give Brett and Keith a hug for me, man.
I sure will. Yeah. Thanks so much. God bless you guys. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you. Hey, you're listening to Heartbeat Radio. Ross just left to get back to the wedding he's at. And Dan Murphy and Bruce and I are on. We got about 14 minutes left. Dan, you want to give us some parting shots and some parting comments, and we'll start easing out of here for the night.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been a really fascinating conversation, and this is really the crux of wrestling in 2014 now. I think we're at a really interesting stage in pro wrestling history where we still have a lot of the guys, the veterans like yourselves and the people that you came up with that represented traditional pro wrestling and what wrestling is kind of becoming now, where it's a lot more tightly scripted. It's really one promotion kind of runs the whole show. And it's really kind of interesting. We're at this weird kind of crossroads of where wrestling is going to go, whether it's going to continue to be homogenized and kind of industrialized, I guess, maybe by WWE, or whether the spirit of pro wrestling that brought it to this point can really kind of survive and find ways to keep things fresh and new going forward. And it's really neat to think about, as we've kind of talked about here in this conversation today, talking about the history and all of those great names that you mentioned and recognizing the history of those people, then looking ahead of who's next, who's going to carry on that history, both in the ring and as the Hall of Fame, as somebody who can document that and keep that. And it's really kind of neat now, like I said, that we have the technology. There's still the magazines, but now there's the internet. There's these ways, there's radio shows like this, where you can still reach out to the masses, still tell some of those stories and pass on that oral history. And it's really kind of neat to kind of bridge this transitional period through using new technology. So it's really a great time to be a pro wrestling fan right now.
Yeah, I'd like to see the grassroots fortified a hell of a lot more. And like Johnny was saying, you know, with those there's like 200 promotions in Texas alone or whatever. But as I said before, I think they need to start setting the bar higher. And, you know, not to be critical, but I think all too many of them, and there's, you know, an A to Z of Mickey Mouse promotions up here in Western Canada too. And I think they got to, as I said before, be an alternative, not a cheap copy. And they got to do, you know, use wrestling to set up everything else, not the other way around. And I'd cut back on the gimmicks and the artificial additives and you know, the horse shit. And I think they need to go back to, with, and I'm not advocating everyone wearing wool tights and black boots that come up past your ankle and all that stuff, but you go back to wrestling and reestablish some semblance of realism and credibility. And I might sound like I'm living in the past, but I think you need to kayfabe a bit, and you don't need to be divulging all the inner aspects of the business and all like that. And I know I'm just talking about stuff that I found successful, but I've been fortunate enough to have been all over the damn planet with this, and the ones that made the biggest impression on me were the ones who took it, you know, seriously and, did the things that I was saying. And I would venture to say guys like Daniel Bryan came up in that kind of an environment, and he's a reflection of what old school really is all about. And I think old school is where it's at. Too many people get the wrong impression or whatever the hell old school is. You know, old school is, the wool tights and the black boots and all, but everything you do is for a purpose, and you protect the business, and, more is not better, you know. Do less high spots and more wrestling, and whatever you do should be meaningful and purposeful, you know. And you don't need 20 matches on a card and all the other additives, any of those smaller
in 1967, I went and spent the summer with my brother Kenny in Tampa, Florida. They had sent him down there to train with Hiro Matsuda. And in the process of going down there, I got to meet the Kangaroos and Leo Garibaldi and some of the Grahams and Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes, and just the list goes on. But I'll never forget a gentleman saying to me one night, as I got to the building early with my brother Kenny, and he told me to go over here and set, and this promoter came up to me, and his name was Dickie Steinborn, and he said to me,
"Oh yeah, I know
that
old Dickie."
He said, "Kid, as long as that marquee out there says wrestling, we need to do some." And I had already started wrestling as an amateur, and I think if the independents of today could take heed to anything, it would be that saying right there, that if your marquee is going to say wrestling, you probably ought to do some. And that would help the independent guys today out a lot.
Too many of these guys got to actually spend some time actually analyzing what the hell wrestling is. Too many of them don't even, for me, Bobby's heard me say it, but in all too many cases, it's a glorified exercise of flinging shit against the wall and hoping something will stick. You know, they have no idea why they're doing what they're doing, or, if the odd time they get a pop by accident, they try to do 20 high spots then, or like there's little or no tangible method to the madness. And you got to actually go back to square one and analyze what it is, how you're going to insert yourself into the equation, and all of those things. And as we were talking about before, those road trips and the old veterans, they would instill that in you. Nowadays, I guess you got to find your way yourself, but you can go online and anytime you get a chance to hook up with any of those old legends, if you ever happen to be at a place like Amsterdam, or they're in a territory, or pick their brains. If you get some old guy like Leo Burke or Leo Garibaldi or Gene LaBelle or Johnny or Ken Mantell or Terry Funk or Harley, those guys, and most of them are really generous with their advice and their sharing perspectives. But I think some of that's, going to enhance your ability, your chances of success as much as anything, And I keep talking about you're better off trying to be, something different than trying to be a copy of whatever the hell is already out there.
Absolutely. If Vince is Coca-Cola, buddy, you need to be 7-Up. Hey, Dan, thanks for being on tonight on Heartbeat Radio with Bruce and myself. And, buddy, I hope we can continue this conversation on another time and another day, because I'd love to get your perspective on a lot of this stuff of today.
Absolutely, guys. My pleasure.
Week.
Thank you.
Are you on next week, Johnny? I hear that Les Thatcher and Mike Mooneyham and some of those guys.
I'm
going to
be
on,
I think, after the Cauliflower Alley Club. I'll be out at Cauliflower Alley in a couple of weeks, and I might be on for the recap on that, I think. But we'll see how things go.
Dan, okay, thanks a lot, my friend.
All right, thank you very much, guys.
You awesome job, Johnny, and always a pleasure. And I look forward to talking to the other guys, too. Thank you.
Hey, Bruce, thanks a lot, man, for having me on tonight and helping you host this thing. I look forward, if you need me next week with Les Thatcher, I'll come on and tie up and hammer Locky myself if we need to and get the job done. But I know Bobby's still hanging on. Let's let Bobby say his goodnights, and then we'll say our goodbyes. Hey, Bobby, you still there? Nope, I think Bobby left me. I'm sorry. So it's just you and I, Bruce. And again, man, thank you so much for letting me be a part of it tonight. Heartbeat Radio right here on the Pro Wrestling Network. And again, I hope that you and I are passing a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of history onto these guys, and they get a chance to learn this business the real way and understand the guys that went before and what they did to allow them to do the things they're doing today.
Yeah, I echo that entirely, and I'm hoping that we sort of get any of you listeners out there, feel free to call in. I love to hear from any of you fans and get some perspectives, things you like and don't like about it, or just perspectives about the business or whatever. So we should have fun next week with Mike Mooneyham and Les Thatcher, and the week after that we'll be sharing reflections about my brother Owen. So it should be two really interesting shows in the next 2 weeks.
Absolutely, and I want to give my thanks to, of course, my buddy Bruce, to Bob Johnson and Greg DeMarco and everybody at ProWrestlingPowerhouseRadio.com. And for any information on the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, it's PWHF.org. Or if you need any information, you can contact myself at JohnnyMantell.com, and I can get you the information or anything you need to know. The show's coming up here next week. On 5/18, like Bruce said, Les Thatcher and Mike Mooneyham is going to be on. And then on the 25th, the anniversary tribute show for Owen Hart, and there's going to be Brian Blair, Mick Foley, Jimmy Corduas, and Jeff Jarrett. So that'll be quite a crowd. And again, Bruce, if you need me to help keep them in the ring or keep them on the floor, wherever we want to keep them, all you got to do is tell me, my friend.
Yeah, you keep them honest, Johnny. That's what you're best at. So I'll look forward to it next week, and I'd be delighted if you can take from your schedule to join us next week. And it should be fun. And as Ed Whelan said, says, it'll be a ring-a-ding-dong dandy.
There you go. Well, Bruce, have a great night, man. Enjoy the evening in Canada, and we look forward to talking to you very soon. And matter of fact, next weekend I'll be in New York up there, so maybe Ross and I, when we're together, we won't prank you, but we'll call you.
Sounds good. All the best.
All right. Thanks,
Bruce. Take care, Johnny. Thank you.
Yeah, all right. You've all been listening to Heartbeat Radio right here on Mother's Day, May 11th, 2014. Heartbeat Radio is brought to you by ProWrestlingPowerhouseRadio.com. You know, if you're listening to this show or if you're watching it or listening on the Internet, you can call 760-888-5789, and you can call and be a guest on the show. Most of the time they take callers in the second hour. I'm sorry I lost a couple of you tonight. We do this again. We'll try to get back to it. But this is Johnny Mantell, the cowboy Johnny Mantell in Montague County, Texas, bringing you the Heartbeat Radio Show tonight with my dear friend Bruce. Ross, we're looking forward to seeing you up at the Hall of Fame this weekend. So until next time, everybody involved with the Heartbeat Radio, Johnny Mantell saying, see ya!